Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study in 2 Samuel. We're going to be picking up in 2 Samuel 19, the latter part of verse 8, where it says, "Now Israel had fled, each to his tent," which means that we've left the scene back over with David's troop in the eastern Jordan area, east of the Jordan. Now we're going back to Israel on the west bank. And we're going to kind of see what's happening there. "And all the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies.'" So verses 9 and 10 are basically kind of a summary of what the Israelites are talking about. "The man we anointed, Absalom, has been defeated. David delivered us from our enemies. Let's bring David back." Now, this is what the northern tribes were saying. They wanted to get together and bring David back. Apparently, some kind of coronation parade, an official invitation. In verses 11 through 15, David hears this, and he wants Judah to bring him back. He wants his own people to come and ask him to come, because much of Absalom's truth and support came from Judah. And David wants his own tribe to be involved in this invitation, not just the northern 10 tribes. Well, how does he do that? Well, he makes some overtures or gestures toward Judah. First is that Zadok and Abiathar, the high priest in Jerusalem, go and talk to the elders of Judah about David. Notice he says to them, to the two high priests, "Go and speak to the elders and say, 'Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house?'" Notice in verse 13 is the second kind of concession he makes. "And say, 'Amsa, you are not bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. May God do so to me and more, if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab.'" Now, exactly why would he do this? Well, I was looking at one of my, I wrote down here, I wanted to pick up on it, about the relationship between Joab and Amasa. Now, the two, Abigail is Amasa's mother, and Zariah is Joab and Abishai and Ashiel's mother. Both of them were half-sisters of David. Now, this is only an assumption, but it seems to be that David's mother was married before and had these two girls, and then she married Jesse. Now, there may be some corruption in the Hebrew text about the one name in several places, but we're not 100% sure of that. So this was a relative. Joab was a relative. The same kind of relative was Amasa. Now, I think offering him to be the commander in place of Joab did two things. It showed that he wanted to reconcile with Judah. It also showed how angry he was at Joab over two things, I think. Number one, is speaking to him so harshly, we saw last lesson, but primarily, again, not obeying his command and intentionally killing Absalom when David asked him not to do that. And so Joab is removed. That's going to be a way of endearing himself to Judah, I think. "And he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, and they sent word to the king, saying, 'Return, you and all your servants.'" And so they're going to meet at Gilgal. Now, Gilgal, we only learned this thing is mentioned only one time here in these historical books. It's mentioned often in the book of Joshua, and of course it's the place they camped initially as they crossed the Jordan. In Hebrew it means a circle, and we're not sure exactly where it is. So David is going to come back on the brink of Jordan. There's something kind of like a coronation ceremony in him crossing over Jordan. Exactly the meaning there is somewhat lost. The same people that he encountered as he left Jerusalem, he will encounter again as he returns. The first one here is Shimei. And this, of course, is the Benjamite that cursed at him and threw a terrible slander at him, accusations in God's name. And now here he comes back. But notice in verse 17, there were 1,000 other Benjamin tribesmen with him. Now, this was Saul's tribe. Why 1,000 other Benjamite men there? There's two theories. Number one says, this shows Shimei's support. And the other theory is just the opposite, says these men didn't want David to think that all of them supported Shimei, so they came themselves showing that they supported him as a tribal group, and which it is, of course, we can't tell from the text. And then there was Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, He also was there with all his sons and all his servants. Why? Because David's going to hear the other side of the story now from Mephibosheth. And, it's just terribly hard in the Bible to know if Ziba is lying or if Mephibosheth is lying. One of them seems to be lying. One of them has to be lying. But which it is, we don't know. And obviously, David didn't know because he's going to split the property of Saul between the two. Now, notice here that this man who cursed him from the tribe of Benjamin now wants David not to take revenge on him. But Abishai says, let's kill him right now because he cursed the Lord's anointed. Now, what does that mean? Well, it was a crime to curse the Lord's anointed. You might want to see Exodus 22:28. In cursing God's anointed leader, in a sense, you're cursing God. And so they said, no, let's put him to death. He's cursing God, therefore, by cursing the anointed. And David said, look at verse 22. It's kind of his way of saying, boy, you guys, you and your brother are so tough. He even uses the word that you this day are an adversary to me. Now, this literally is the Hebrew word Satan. That means that when Jesus in Matthew 16 said, get thee behind me, Satan, to Peter, he may have been using it in a non-personal sense, just as he's using it in a non-personal sense here. I'm not saying there is no personal devil. I'm simply saying the word in Hebrew can also be used in a non-personal way of someone who's just trying to hurt you here by wanting to do the right thing but causing the wrong problem. Why? To take vengeance on a Benjamite right then in the presence of 1,000 Benjamite men would have been to cause disunity and a possible splitting of the kingdom again. So David's willing to kind of let these old wounds lie for a while. Woo! He's going to get this guy with Solomon. He's going to get most of these guys with Solomon. He's going to say, I'm not going to hurt you. Don't worry, I'm not going to kill you. But when he's about to die, he's going to ask his son, son, take care of this boy. Take care of Joab. Take care of these people who've hurt me in my life. And boy, Solomon does. He kills them. And the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. Thus the king swore to him. Now, I want you to please read 1 Kings 2, verses 8 and 9, and 1 Kings 36 through 46, and you'll see what Solomon did. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither. Now, three things said. He neither cared for his feet. Some say he didn't trim his toenails. Some said he didn't wash his feet. We don't know what that means exactly. He didn't trim his mustache. Now, why is the mustache mentioned? Maybe he didn't trim his beard at all. Of course, Jews weren't supposed to trim their beard anyway. I don't know what that means exactly. Nor did he wash his clothes. Oh, he must have been a stinky fellow. From the day that David departed until the day he came home. Now, this seems to imply that Mephibosheth was being slandered by Ziba, that he did care for David, and that he really was mourning for him, not trying to be king in his place. This lends support to Mephibosheth's loyalty. Whether that's true or not, we just don't know. Then in verse 27, this little phrase is mentioned again, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. We saw that same metaphor or idiom back in 2 Samuel 14:17, 14:20. This is not meaning that the king had the wisdom of an angel, but it is an idiom meaning the king, who was the supreme judge in Israel, had the counsel of God, the wisdom of God, and the people recognized that. In verse 29, we see that I don't think David knew who to believe. He didn't want to look like a fool in giving all the land to Ziba and wronging Mephibosheth. And so what I think he did was, I'm going to give half to each of you. He's a little miffed that that Mephibosheth is bringing all his own family troubles up in the middle of David's problems. He says, why are you talking to me about this? But I'll divide the land. And so it's kind of a way of David saying, I don't know who to believe. And I don't either. Now this Bazili, I'm not sure exactly how to say it, this Gittite was a very kind man to David. Apparently he had paid for a lot of David's keep there and was very generous. He was 80 years old, we learned from verse 32. He came back as far as the Jordan with David. David says, come to my palace. You've taken care of me. I want to take care of you. And the man in verse 35 says, look, I'm 80 years old. I can't distinguish between good and bad. Now, these are signs of age. This is not in the moral sense. It seems to imply I can't enjoy the pleasures of the court. I sometimes make silly decisions now that I'm older. Maybe I don't understand everything, something like that. Then he said, I can't taste my food or drink. I'm losing my taste. Number three, I can't hear anymore the songs of singers. He's saying, I wouldn't be any good to you at court. I can't enjoy the things y'all are going to enjoy. I'm too old. I want to go home and die in my own city, be buried to my father and mother. That's interesting, and mother's unusual there. And the king says, fine, I'll do that. But then he says, what about my son, Chimham? Would you give to him what you were going to give to me? And the king says, sure. Some say this means pale face. I don't know if the boy was sickly or what, but I'm not sure of that etymology. The Septuagint says it's one of Bezalel's or Bezalel's son. We're not sure. In the Jeremiah 41:17, this very name, Chimham, is mentioned as having some land around Bethlehem. Some have assumed that maybe the king gave him a royal land grant around Bethlehem, but we're just not certain of that. Notice the king kissed him, blessed him. That's a sign of their friendship, and the man went home. Now in verse 40, the king went on to Gilgal. He crossed over the Jordan. Chimham went with him, all the people of Judah, and so half of the people of Israel accompanied the king. Now it's interesting, half of the people of Israel, because what we're going to see is the people of Israel, the northern tribes, are going to arrive, and they're going to say, why did you bring the king over Jordan without waiting for us? Why are you trying to steal all his favors, trying to make us look bad by only you bringing him into the promised land again? And there's some truth to that. They did kind of rush it up. The Judah people in verse 42 say, hey, we haven't taken any advantage of you. What has the king given to us? What have we done to you? There's a real jealousy factor here. There's always been that undercurrent among this coalition of the 12 tribes, jealousy among each one of them, an undercurrent of you're somehow hurting me and mine. And we're going to see it's going to finally issue in the splitting of the 12 tribes under Solomon's son Rehoboam and a northern a labor leader, Jeroboam the First, in 922. This is kind of a foreshadowing of that. And the men of Judah were uglier, more severe than the men of Israel, and the thing kind of breaks off. Well, because of the ugliness of this confrontation at the end of chapter 19, look what happened in chapter 20. Now, a worthless fellow, and literally this is the son of Belial. Later on, that'll become an intertestamental title for Satan in the Jewish apocryphal books. Here it just means a worthless fellow, a good-for-nothing fellow, happened to be there, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. Again, this undercurrent of Saul is always here. And he blew the trumpet. Remember how Joab had blown the trumpet? Now this man blows the trumpet, a sign of rebellion, a sign of military gathering. This is what he said. We have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, O Israel. It's a way of calling them to leave, not war, but succession. It's interesting to me that when Jeroboam the First took the northern 10 tribes away from Solomon's son, he pretty much quotes this very same thing in 1 Kings 12:16, and you might want to see that. Now, notice in verse 2. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and following Sheba. This seems like a massive revolt. Seems like a large part of Israel followed him. But in the text that follows, it's really a pretty insignificant. Maybe on the spur of the moment, this tribal jealousy kind of arose, but they really didn't support the man. Or maybe they found out he was a poor leader quickly and didn't support him. But it seems the man is pretty much alone when he's at the end. And exactly what verse 2 means, we're uncertain. Some have assumed he's a relative of Saul, but the name is spelled differently as far as his father, and we're not exactly sure of that connection. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David, followed Sheba. Men of Judah held fast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem, took him back to his home. And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep the house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, and did not go into them, so they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. Now this goes back to what Absalom did to them in chapter 16, verses 21 and 22. Remember they put a tent on the roof at the advice of David's earlier counselor, Ahithophel, and he went into these concubines, showing that he was the new king, showing that he had made a complete break with David against the Levitical law, but a sign the king was going to be dead, or and now these women were like widows of Absalom. They were David's concubines, but now he could not go into them again because of what Absalom had done. They lived separate in the harem the rest of their lives. Then the king said to Amasa, call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Now, there's some undercurrent here. 3 days seems a very short time to get a levy or a recruitment from the nation of Judah. Is David setting a trap for this man to replace him with Joab or one of the other leaders, or Abishai? We're not sure. It seems to be much too short of a time, and he does not make the time. And so in verse 5, so Amasa went to call the men of Judah, but delayed longer than the time set which had been appointed him. And David said to Abishai, now it's interesting, the Masoretic text has Abishai, but the Peshitta, which is the Syriac translation, an early version done around the 5th century A.D., has Joab. I think Abishai is probably right, because I think Joab was certainly out of favor with the king. Now, Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take the Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find himself fortified cities and escape from our sight. Now, I think it's interesting here that David sees this revolt as having real potential. He understands this undercurrent of the northern 10 tribes. Maybe he realized that he embarrassed them by crossing over too early with Judah only, and he recognizes the possibility or potential that this undercurrent has. So Joab's men went out after him, along with these two groups are part of the mercenary personal bodyguard of David. The fact that they would go away from David, leave him, and go to fight this man shows the seriousness that David saw this rebellion. We think that these are from the island of Crete and the Philistines. Some say the Philistines are from Crete. We know they're Aegean peoples. And so this was the mercenary bodyguard that was so faithful to David throughout his life. And all the mighty men, this may be the 30, those famous mighty men who were David's special bodyguards that stayed with him all the time, they're going to go to battle too, which shows David was really worried about this revolt. They went out from Jerusalem, pursued Sheba, and they were at the large stone at Gibeon. That's interesting. This large stone at Gibeon is mentioned several times earlier. It's mentioned in 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 13. It's mentioned in chapter 3, verse 30. There's even said to be a worship site at a large stone in 1 Kings 3, 4, and that may be this large stone at Gibeon. Amasa came to meet them. Now, Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath, fastened to his waist. And as he went forward, it fell out. Now, there's two theories here. Some say that the sword fell out of the scabbard and fell into the tucked-up clothes that he was wearing to ride the horse or whatever, he was mule or whatever. And the knife fell in the fold of the clothes, so it was easily to get. Others say there were two swords, and one of them fell to the ground, and so Amasa would say, ah, he's dropped his sword, he didn't pick it up, he's friendly. When in reality, it was kind of a ruse. In reality, there was another sword there, and when he grabbed his beard to kiss his cheek, he thrust that sword into his belly. Now, here is Joab acting the same kind of person for self-interest. He's going to say, David can't fire me. As he killed Abner in trickery by stabbing him in the belly, he does the same thing to his relative here. Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground and did not strike him again, and he died. And Joab and Abishai his brother pursued Sheba. Now there stood by one of Joab's young men and said, whoever favors Joab, whoever favors David, let him follow Joab. Now here seems to be something that maybe Amasa's purposes were not all that loyal either. Maybe he was trying to form a rebellion. And for the man says, if you're really for David, then follow Joab. Undercurrent here that maybe some other plots were behind, but we just can't draw it out from the text too much. Now, the men, apparently the man was just writhing in pain in his own blood in the middle of the road, whirling around in it. The people that he had just recruited from Judah were watching in amazement. This young man saw that all the other troops were not following Joab, so he drug him off the road and covered him over with something, and the troops kind of broke their trance. And they went on and followed Joab. They had the rebellion to put down. They couldn't worry about this right now. And they went on and made one unified army. Ugh. Verse 13, and all the men passed by on after Joab. And that'll be the recruits, I think. Now notice where this man had fled to in verse 14. It's called Abel, even to Beth Maacah, and with all the Beerites. Now, boy, we don't know exactly what that is. We think, because of some other connections, that this city was very close to Dan in the far north. And so he had apparently moved all the way through the tribes of Israel and found very little support and was way up north in one of these northern cities. But it was still an Israelite city. We learned that from 1 Kings 15:20. In that it mentions a loyal city. And a matter of fact, what's going to happen in the next few verses is going to show they claim to be loyal to Israelite traditions. Now, the Beerites are interesting. Some say the word Beer, B-E-E-R, in Hebrew means well. Were these people of the well? Well, possibly, but what well? There's Beersheba and a million other ones, Well of the Seven, and on and on. We're not sure. We don't meet these people anywhere else in the Bible by this name, and we just don't know who they were. Now, apparently Joab, when they found that the man was in the city, they put up siege mounds. It must have taken a long time because it was earthwork. It had to be put against these city walls so that they could storm the city. And while they were doing all of this activity, it must have taken a long time. And why there wasn't more discussion went on, I don't know. But this one older wise woman came to the city wall and said, "I want to speak to Joab." And Joab came and said, "Yes." And she said, "Would you tell me why you're going to destroy this city that's faithful to Israel? Kill these Israeli mother," play on the word mother, meaning the woman here, and the city is also feminine. "Why are you going to destroy an inheritance of an Israelite city?" And Joab says, I don't want to do that. I'm not trying to destroy a faithful city of Israel. I'm trying to catch this man who rebelled against David." And the woman says, "What man?" It's like she didn't even know who and what was happening. Now, there's a lot that must be left out here. How could they build all these siege works against the city, this whole Israeli army outside, and no one know why until this one lady asked, after a lot of preparations for war had been made? I don't know. But once she finds out, said, "What's the man's name?" They find the man's name, and she said, "Give me a minute, and I'll throw his head over the wall." And she did. And Joab recognized him, and the army withdrew. It's amazing here that they didn't know what was happening, but they didn't. And that ended that rebellion. Now, beginning in verse 23 through 26 is the second list of David's administrators, advisors, governmental structure. The first list is very much like this, found in chapter 8, verses 15 through 18. There is an added position here, so I want to go through this if I could. Notice this loyal troops, this bodyguard of Cretans and Philistines are mentioned here again, and their commander. But in verse 24, we have Adoram, which may be an abbreviation for Hadad-Aram, we're not sure, who was over the forced labor. Now, this will be a very important governmental post in Solomon's day. Here, it seems, with probably only prisoners of war and foreigners. But in Solomon's day, he's going to take a forced labor from the tribes to do his building projects. You might want to see 1 Kings 4:6 and 5:14, where a man very similar to this, with just an added I in his name, is also over the forced labor. Many of us assume it's the same man. Here appointed young and was the same man during Solomon's day. Matter of fact, he seems to be the same man possibly even in Rehoboam's day, Solomon's son. He must have been an old dude then. We find this from 1 Kings 12:18, where he is stoned to death when he tries to go to the northern tribes and get forced labor. So we're not sure if it's the same man or his son has the same name or what exactly. Now also we have the recorder and the scribe mentioned here. These are both terms we find in Egyptian courts. The first term, the recorder, means one who reminds. Kind of a man who reminds the king about the schedule, keeps his court cases flowing, lets people into the chamber and all of that. And then the scribe would be someone who keeps official records so they can check what the decisions the king made and what taxes were paid and on and on. Now, Zadok and Abathar, these two twin guys, again, high priests are mentioned. And then, funny enough, another man is named priest, Ira, the Jairite. We're not sure who he is. We're not sure if this is Jair, a city, or some other location we don't know. Was also a priest to David. Some say he replaced David's sons as Cohen or priest, and his David's sons are said to be priests in chapter 8, 18. Now, the word Cohen, which means priest, has an uncertain etymology, and we're not certain if it originally meant someone who was a court official and not just a religious functionary. Matter of fact, there's another place, I didn't write it down, I think it's in the Kings, where this same person is called a priest, a friend of the king, which is a title for a close counselor. I don't think that this man offered sacrifices or was a high priest. I think he was another governmental official that we don't know, and that helps explain chapter 8, verse 18, because David's sons couldn't be priests either. He's from the wrong tribe. And even if Zadok is the high priest of Jebus, and they had the sons of the king were priests, it just is too far-fetched for me. Well, that ends this section of 2 Samuel. I think it shows us the tragedy of fulfilled prophecy in the life of David because of his sex sin and murder of Uriah. His own family has fallen apart. The succession of his court is a disaster. His sons are dying and committing sexual sins and apostasies with his own concubines. What a terrible thing. It reminds us that sin always runs its course. God can forgive, but sin always runs its course. I think we see some of the intrigue and undercurrent in David's palace of these ambitious men he surrounded himself with. It's true in all palaces and power structures. It's true among the people of God. But somehow God's working through all of this to bring about His will in the life of His people. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.